Well, I want to add my thanks, too, for my wife's teaching last week. And she told me that she gave a little bit of report of what I was doing in Seattle and Vancouver. And, you know, it was two Sundays ago that I outlined the how to test a creation model in our church service. And many of you and others came up and asked if I could, you know, field a few questions on that 35-minute summary of the two-hour message. So I'm going to give you a chance to do that. And in fact, I got some questions for you on that by way of follow-up. Then I want to get into finishing up the section we're dealing with on the extent of the flood, global, local, universal, what that's all about. So we'll return to that. But, you know, last time I was here, one of you slipped me this little thing, and it talks about a latter-day Noah. And so I'm just going to read it to you. And it speaks about the Noah that's going to be coming about in these ends of days. The Lord spoke to this modern-day Noah and said, Noah, 6 months I'm going to make it rain until the whole world is covered with water and all the evil things are destroyed. I want to save a few good people and two of every living thing on the planet, and I'm ordering you to build an ark. And in a flash of lightning, he delivered the specifications for the building of this ark. Okay, Noah said, trembling with fear and fumbling with the blueprints, I'm your man. This time he got blueprints. 6 months and it starts to rain, thundered the Lord. You better have my ark completed or learn to swim for a long, long time. 6 months passed, and the sky began to cloud up, and the rain began to fall in torrents. And the Lord looked down and saw Noah sitting in his yard weeping, and there was no ark. Noah, shouted the Lord, where's my ark? A lightning bolt crashed into the ground right beside Noah. Lord, please forgive me, begged Noah. I did my best, but there were some problems. First, I had to get a building permit for the ark's construction. But your plans did not meet their codes, so I had to hire an engineer to redo the plans, only to get into a long argument about whether to include a fire sprinkler system. My neighbor objected, claiming that I was violating zoning ordinances by building the ark in my front yard, so I had to get a variance from the city planning board. Then I had a big problem getting enough wood for the ark, because there was a ban on cutting trees to save a spotted owl. I tried to convince the environmentalists and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that I needed the wood to save the owls, but they wouldn't let me catch them, so no owls. Next, I started gathering up the animals, but got sued by an animal rights group that objected to me taking along only two of each kind. Just when the suit got dismissed, the EPA informed me that I couldn't complete the work without filing an environmental impact statement on your proposed flood. They didn't take kindly to the idea that they had no jurisdiction over the conduct of a supreme being. Then the Corps of Engineers wanted a map of the proposed flood plan. I sent them a globe. Right now, I'm trying to resolve a complaint with the Equal Opportunities Commission over how many minorities I'm supposed to hire. The IRS has seized all my assets, claiming that I'm trying to leave the country. And I just got notice from the state that I own some kind, that I owe some kind of use tax. Really, I don't think I can finish this ark in less than 5 years. With that, the sky cleared, the sun began to shine, and a rainbow arched across the sky. Noah looked up and smiled. You mean you're not going to destroy the world? He asked God hopefully. No, said the Lord, I'm too late. The government already has done it. So, I don't know who gave this to me, but anyways. Well, thank you, Mel. I really did enjoy that. So, maybe we should post that on our Paradox's website, eh? I don't know. All right. No, pardon me. Right. Copies of that available? Well, hey, it's up here if any of you want to. We could make copies. So, kind of reminds me of that one that was circulating years ago about Genesis 1, but same kind of theme. Okay, I did say I would take a few questions before we launch back into a discussion on the extent of the flood, on the creation model. And I got a question for you, by the way. And that is, you heard the 10 tests I laid out. And by the way, as I mentioned, I think in at least two of the services, there are many more than those 10 tests. I only gave you about half the tests that one could devise for testing creation models. But a question I want to throw out, remember I kept making the comment, these are ways you can test the model, but a good model will make predictions about what scientists will discover in the future. What I thought would be fun is to challenge you to give me, based on the 10 tests, what would be some predictions we could make about what scientists would discover. And incidentally, I'd appreciate your prayers. Tomorrow morning, I'm going on the radio. It's a secular news radio program. And it's going to be a discussion with the host, who's not a believer, an atheist who heads up the National Center for Science Education. It's an organization that's basically founded to smash down all the creationists. And then there's Ken Ham with Answers in Genesis, who's one of the more extreme variants of the young earth creationist crowd. And I thought they would stick me in the middle. So we have 1 hour, probably about 30 minutes with all the ad breaks. But I appreciate your prayers that, I thought very seriously of just not participating because I know how Eugenie Scott and Ken Ham behave. But felt if I didn't participate, then once again, the public would get the idea there's only two positions, just the two polar extremes. So against my better judgment, I'm going to dive into it. I think it's 9 o'clock, isn't it, Kathy? 9 to 10, I believe. Either 9 to 10 or 10 to 11. I think it's 9 to 10, right? Yeah, it's Denver. Yeah. It'll be airing at 10 o'clock in Denver. And I'm not sure it's being picked up by other stations, but they will be posting the transcript on their website. And this is the biggest news station in Denver. So. Well, that's right. Frankly, the worst way to communicate science is through sound bites. I hate having to do it, but when you're on a radio program like this, that's all you got to do. And so you really can't. And that's my tendency. Well, let me explain the background behind this, and you just don't have time. You'll never make your point if you do that. You just have to, zip out a half phrase. So.
For example.
Well, whatever. I appreciate your prayers, okay? Just that. All right. So, well, mainly I'm going to try to make the point. And I may not get a chance, but I'm going to have to be aggressive enough to do something, I guess, and that is that, the atheist position in creation evolution depends on a breakdown in the laws of physics. Likewise, the young earth creationist position. The position we espouse is proposing that the laws of physics have never changed since the creation event. And if people would talk about that, we would really be able to get some headway. But instead, the debate is all over, this guy doesn't have a good character. This guy doesn't have... I mean, they're both sides are really good at character assassination and arguing about things that are peripheral. To me, the key thing is, are we talking about a compromise of the Bible, a compromise of the record of nature? And that's what I'm getting from Eugenie Scott. Throw out the Bible, keep the science. Ken Ham, throw out the science, keep the Bible. And then what we're saying is you don't have to compromise either. They both have a lot more in common with one another than they have with me. So maybe we could make that point too. That would be good. Okay. All right, what are some predictions we could make based on the creation model? Yes.
I found my notes, so I can step up to that.
All right.
All right, they're doing a lot of work digging up species. They want to find progenitors of man. I will predict, for example, that this idea of a sudden increase in rainfall will become more clearly stated.
Very good.
Another
yeah.
would be the Cambrian explosion. You know, that one that they found in China. Cynanozoan levitum.
Mm-hmm.
You pointed out there'll be lots more like that. It's going to make it increasingly difficult for evolution with that sudden rise of many new life.
Yeah. And they got all those mass extinction events where we see a sudden rise thereafter, you know, with better dating methods. And by the way, there's a magnetic susceptibility technique that's just been developed that has the potential to pinpoint speciation events and extinction events to a precision of 10,000 years. So that what that would mean is instead of being able to say the Cambrian explosion took place over 5 million years or less, it would now become 10,000 years or less. So, and likewise, the recovery from the three dinosaur extermination catastrophes, if we can demonstrate that that's 10,000 years or less in all three cases, it's going to be extremely difficult, impossible to support any naturalist interpretation. So, thanks. That's one very good way to, we can predict what people will discover based on the creation model. Yes. Well, one of the problems in trying to resolve creation-evolution debates is that we've not been able to pinpoint events in the fossil record very accurately. You know, when I went to school, they were saying, well, the Cambrian explosion can be pinned down to a range of 50 million years. And so they would say that all the Cambrian events took place over a time span of 50 million years. Now, that's cheating in one sense, because what the data said was anywhere between 0 and 50 million years. And this discovery in China, what it did is it shrunk the error bar down by almost a factor of 10. So now that means all this Cambrian activity takes place in a window of time that's much briefer than 10 million years instead of 50 million. This magnetic susceptibility technique would have the potential to pinpoint fossil record events to a precision of 10 to 20,000 years. And so if it really was zero, for example, now you'd be coming up with an answer between 0 and 20,000 instead of 0 and 5 million. And the whole point is the more accurately you can pin down these dramatic events, and dramatic events take place in two contexts, events that will wipe out, say, two-thirds of all the species of life on planet Earth. And then the recovery from that, where you see the sudden emergence of millions of new species right after that catastrophe. And there's one discovery that demonstrates that the recovery from the Cretaceous-Tertiary catastrophe, that's the one that took place 65 million years ago. Remember that asteroid that smacked into the Yucatan Peninsula? The recovery from that time, which means the emergence of millions of new species to replace the millions that went extinct, has now been demonstrated to be about 5,000 years. So, now the one promoting a Darwinist interpretation is faced with a challenge. How do you get millions of species that weren't there before, coming from those that survived the Cretaceous-Tertiary catastrophe, how do you get that evolving in just 5,000 years? And the challenge is bigger than what you think, because the catastrophe wipes out all the big creatures. So you have to evolve from tiny stuff, not big stuff. And, you know, we're talking about all these birds and mammals that emerge. And how do you get that when everything big has been wiped out? Yes, Wes. Yeah, this method has the potential of dating fossils to that degree of precision. And so, yeah, I'm not quite catching your point, Wes. Well, that's it. I mean, you know, living creatures always have a fair amount of iron in them. And so what you're really dating is when the iron was absorbed into this creature. And if you can pin that down to that degree of precision. Well, carbon-14 only works for something that's been around for 20,000 years or less. Since it's got a half-life of 5,700 years, once you get past 20,000 years, the method becomes useless. For most of the fossil record, we are lacking adequate radiometric checks on the dates. And if we're talking something that's, say, a half billion years old, there is no radiometric tool that's going to give you precision anywhere close to 10,000 years, error bar. And so, up till now, paleontologists have had to be satisfied with the precisions of plus or minus 5 million years, plus or minus 10 million years, plus or minus 20 million years, plus or minus 50 million years. So coming up with a new method that will get it down to 10 or 20,000 years would be, the method's now in place. It just hasn't been exploited yet. And so once this method begins to be applied to paleontology, we're going to see dramatic resolution in a lot of these creation evolution discussions. So that's the second area where we, as Christians, based on a creation model, can say this is what scientists ought to discover. Yes?
If I'm right, I think what Wes was trying to say is, how can you determine the earliest time that these species were around if perhaps we don't find fossils from the earliest end of these species? Is that what
you're saying?
Well, I mean, you need something somewhat catastrophic to get a fossil in the first place. I mean, when most animals and plants die, all their material decays, even the bones decay. No, but I think the point is made, for example, the fossil record is only about 95% complete. And that's because during normal times, most animals, when they die, are not going to leave fossilized remains. If you get some kind of a lava flow, an asteroid collision, you get huge floods, that will result in creatures being fossilized. And so, you might have this amazing magnetic susceptibility method, but if you're applying it to a period within the fossil record where no catastrophes are taking place, it's not going to do any good. You're not going to come up with fossils. On the other hand, these catastrophes do take place frequently enough that the method should still be effective. The recovery from the Cretaceous-Tertiary disaster involved a lot of catastrophes in itself, which is why we get this pinpoint of 5,000 years. So, but it's not going to work across the whole fossil record. Ultimately, the fossil record is never going to be proven to be complete. Yes. Well, you know what? I didn't come here prepared with those details. I didn't think somebody was going to ask me that question. We did write an article on it in Facts and Faith. And a lot of you might not have missed it because I think we titled it Magnetism and Dating, and a lot of you thought I had to deal with relationships. And really, it was an article on this new exotic geophysical method.
Something I wrote.
Yeah, I think it was called Magnetism and Dating, something like that. But it appeared about 2 years ago in Facts and Faith. So, and was in the middle of the issue. I can visualize the article, but the actual words on the page. But, I mean, Greg is right. It has to do with the iron that animals take into their bodies and how the absorption, the timing of the absorption of that iron can be dated. So it's because you do see the magnetic properties changing.
And we assume that we know the magnetic field.
Yes. Yeah. And so you can check that with magnetic reversals in rocks, what was going on. So. That's one of the requirements, by the way, for life on a planet is you have to be living on a planet that's got a relatively strong field. Now, you might think one Gauss isn't very strong, but when you look at all the planets and stars out there, Earth sticks out like a sore thumb. It's a small planet with a strong magnetic field. Now, it's common for planets like Jupiter to have a strong magnetic field, but for Earth to have such a strong magnetic field, that is uncommon. And it takes that strong magnetic field, number one, to protect the surface life from radiation. Thanks to the Van Allen belts that have been set up by the Earth's magnetic field, we don't get wiped out by solar X-rays destroyed more than we would by cosmic radiation. There's a second factor. That Earth's magnetic field prevents our atmosphere from being sputtered away by the magnetic field of the sun. And so you need the magnetic field to shield. And that's one of the problems people have with speculating about life on the moons of Jupiter, for example. Jupiter's magnetic field sputters away the atmosphere. And so that's why those planets would be non-candidates. That's one of the reasons why. There are many other reasons why they're non-candidates for life. So you need that magnetic field. But that strong magnetic field is also going to manifest itself in the character of rocks. It's one of the ways we can date rocks and also fossils. So that's what's happening there. And by the way, how do we get all the iron? Earth got all that iron thanks to a collision with a planet twice the mass of Mars about 100 million years after the Earth was formed. And that body had to hit at just the right location at just the right time in order to salt the core of our Earth with an extra dose of iron, cobalt, and nickel. And ours is the only planet that has that quantity of cobalt, nickel, and iron sitting in its core. And this enables us to have this nice, strong magnetic field. We wouldn't have this strong magnetic field if it wasn't for that collision happening at just the right time at just the right place. So, has to hit at the right angle. Yeah, if it hits at the wrong angle, you don't get the transfer. I mean, what's critical for the support of life on planet Earth is this collider must hit at just the right location in order to get a transfer of heavy elements to the Earth and for light elements to be transferred to a debris cloud around the Earth that would form the future moon. And it's not just the iron. We also pick up an extra dose of uranium and thorium, which is critical for driving the plate tectonics of planet Earth. And without those plate tectonics, life could only survive for a few million years on the surface of planet Earth. It's because of the plate tectonics that we are able to have a planet whose greenhouse effect goes down step by step as the sun's luminosity goes up step by step. Interestingly, non-Christian physicists and astronomers refer to this as the amazing double coincidence. How we have the sun getting brighter and brighter and brighter as it burns, but that the Earth's greenhouse effect in its atmosphere gets progressively weaker and weaker and weaker. But that wouldn't happen without plate tectonics. So all of us that live here in the Los Angeles area, next time you feel one of those shakers, thank God for his perfect providence for creating an Earth with just the right quantity of earthquakes to keep things nice and balanced so that we get to come upon the scene with the maximum biodeposits. So, yeah, Kathy. Yes. Well, one of the atheists' rebuttal to the creation model is that all is design that physicists and astronomers are seeing the universe is simply the God of the gaps. You see some amazing property in the planet Earth or the sun or the galaxy, and you say, well, that's God that fine-tuned it or designed it to that degree, but if we just simply learn more about what's going on in the universe, we would realize it's not really design, and it's a natural explanation. Well, one way to test that, let's see what happens when we do learn more about the universe. And the track record is the more we learn, the stronger the design evidence has become, and the weaker the God of the gaps argument has become.
then say that Revelation has predicted it, because it says in the last time there should be earthquakes and fires and floods and so on.
No, I don't really recommend that, because what we notice is that the plate tectonic activity on the crust of the Earth has actually declined by a factor of 5. And that's because as these radiometric elements release their radiation, there's an exponential decline in that. And so we don't have as much energy being thrust from radiometric decay today as we did 4 billion years ago. There's also a second interpretation in this that we need to take into account, but has the same effect, namely that what might be contributing to the plate tectonic activity, and by the way, it's not just plate tectonics, it's also volcanism. Volcanoes, too, are driven by the release of heat from radiometric decay, but a second heat source could be, this is a bit speculative, but that when this planet twice the size of Mars collided with the Earth, what that would have done would have been to heat up the core of the Earth. So it would have been a heat impulse from the collision. And that we're seeing the effects of that decay of that heat to this day. And that, too, could be a contributing factor to the plate tectonics and the volcanism. But either way, we would expect that that energy contribution would decline with respect to time. Now then, that also explains why we see the fossil record the way it is. When you look 3 billion years ago, all you see is unicellular life forms. Those unicellular life forms can survive a magnitude 8 earthquake happening every day. We human beings couldn't be created back then because that would have made life rather miserable for us. And so what we have is a picture of God creating the primitive life when the fast rotation period of the Earth and the very high plate tectonic activity wouldn't have been a problem for their survival. It would have been for the big life. And so we have God waiting till just the right time to create the stuff that's as big as ants and termites, and waiting a little bit longer before he makes the elephants. Bacteria are not really bothered that much by magnitude 8 earthquakes. Elephants would be. And likewise, bacteria are not bothered by 2,000 mile per hour winds, but elephants would be. So, yeah, there was another hand. Hey, Greg, you had your hand up?
Also, if the technical scientists are trying to say that all the criteria in the Mississippi State that are under examples now that are specific design characteristics, if they are just being chosen by Christians around the gas that I think you pointed out that these things would fall off the list would be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, if the creationist model is right, we should see the list grow. If it's wrong, we should see the list shrink. And by the way, an important caveat, we creationists could be overzealous in developing design evidences. I fully expect that the 110 items that are on my list of design characteristics for the solar system, it wouldn't surprise me at all if 3 or 4 exposes not being true design evidences. Because, you know, in our analysis of what was going on in the solar system, we could have easily overlooked some factors. So I would expect that because we're human, we make mistakes, we're sinners, that we're going to see some of that evidence fall off. But I also would expect that we're going to see that be replaced with additional evidences as we learn more about the physics of the universe and the solar system. And that's been the track record of the past 30 years. And by the way, the fall-off rate's been very low. Maybe just 1 or 2 items have been dropped from our list over the past 30 years, and we've seen the addition of 80 new items. So you need to look at the overall trend. The noise, there's going to be noise in the system. We may be adding too few, we may be adding too many, because we're human, we don't understand everything, but the long-term trend, given that the creation model is correct, should be one of increasing evidence for God's design of the system. Whereas if the atheists are right, we should see all that evidence disappear. So, and by the way, there are atheist physicists out there working very hard to make it all disappear. But but I'm amused by the records because they usually uncover a lot of things we didn't know about in the first place for design. And that, too, I think is significant. It's not a bunch of zealous Christians that are producing all of this evidence. It's being produced by secular physicists and astronomers. You know, we're simply borrowing from their material. I can't think of anything on the list that's unique to us. It's been stuff that's been uncovered by people who weren't even thinking about the theological perspective. Okay, there's a bunch more ways we can make predictions. In fact, I mentioned one in the sermon. Remember I talked about the chemical clocks? Don't remember that. That was in the very last minute when I was probably talking very rapidly. But I made the comment that, just in the last few months, literally, well, you can go back 2 years even, we have geneticists exploiting genetic clocks for tracing the ancestry of species. But it's only been applied so far to five species, and not for a single species has it been applied with any degree of completeness, not even our own species. Most of the work has been done on the human species. Probably the next most significant one would be Neanderthal. And then the three others are orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. And we're talking about looking at the genes that are only passed through the male line and genes that are only passed through our mothers. And so what you have there are two molecules, sets of molecules, that the only way they can change is through natural mutation. So you've got a way of measuring the natural mutation rate. If you compare modern chimpanzees with chimpanzees that have been dead for 1,000 years or 2,000 years or 3,000 years, then you can look at the range of diversity of the Y chromosome, say, in an orangutan population. And if you know the mutation rate and you know the current range of diversity, that will allow you to determine whether or not the orangutans are descended from multiple individuals or a single individual. It'll also be able to help you determine the time back to the origin of the orangutans, or as the evolutionists say, the splitting off of orangutans from chimpanzees and gorillas. Now then, because it's only been done on, you know, by the way, when you read the research papers, they'll say things like we, you know, did measurements on three orangutans or five gorillas. So this is not like, it's not like astronomy where they're looking at millions of different stars. They only examine a few individuals. The most exhaustive study I've seen done by these clocks is one done in human beings. 38 men. That's all they measured was 38 men. And from that, they try to build a model for the origin of males in the human population. But even that was good enough to demonstrate that these 38 men they sampled are traceable back to one man only. Not a bunch of men, but one man. And so they refer to this as the genetic atom. And then by recovering Y chromosomes from Japanese that have been dead for a while, they're able to determine the date back to that first man and how that's consistent with the biblical date for God creating Adam. It's consistent with the biblical story that we're all descended from one man. And you can do that with on the female end through mitochondrial DNA and come with the same result. It's consistent with the biblical story we're descended from one woman. It's also consistent with the biblical story of when God created that single woman. Now, what you get with orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas, now we're talking sample sizes you can count on a single hand. All they've been able to demonstrate is that these three species do not have a common ancestor. You know, the Darwinian paradigm is that the great apes are all descended from a common ancestor that lived 15 to 30 million years ago. The analysis is already adequate to demonstrate that that's not true. Likewise with Neanderthal, they've been able to prove that Neanderthal's mitochondrial DNA is so different from human DNA, there cannot possibly be any biological link between the two species. And the evidence for Neanderthal is such that we can't establish a link between Neanderthal and any other species. No mammalian species can be tied in with Neanderthal. So it means Neanderthal popped out of the blue from nothing. But isn't that what the Bible says about the origin of the birds and mammals? You know, God comes down and creates them from scratch. Well, one of the predictions I would make is, you know, maybe 10 years from now, we're not going to be looking at just five species. We're going to be looking at several thousand species, all documenting special creation rather than natural evolution or descent from previous existing species. Can you imagine what that would do to, say, the Kansas school board debate if it was well publicized that there were a thousand species of birds and mammals that must be specially created, can't possibly be evolved from previously existing species? You know, technically, we already have the evidence that's strong enough to make that statement. By the way, that didn't happen in Kansas. I don't remember if there was any discussion at all on mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosomes of five primate species. So, but, and then, in terms of what the Bible says about human beings, what if we had sample sizes of a million human beings? And instead of looking at just 200 or 700 nucleotides in the Y chromosome, we looked at a million nucleotide pairs. We should be able to, in great detail, trace the history of humanity out of Eden into all the parts of the earth. And wouldn't that be wonderful if we can pin that down? You know, from an evolutionist perspective, we shouldn't get any of that kind of evidence at all. But that's something we can expect to see happen. Yes, Marge. Yes. Okay, what they're finding with the orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas, and by the way, this argument that our DNA is 98% identical with chimpanzee DNA, that same statement could be made about a whole bunch of species of life. The 2% makes all the difference in the world. The 98% is something we should expect. We've got a single creator creating all these millions of species of life based on DNA, RNA, and proteins. It shouldn't shock us at all that he's using common templates. By the way, we also share 98% of our DNA with yeast, and yet I don't hear evolutionists saying that we're recently descended from yeast. Okay? So the template is all we're seeing there. In fact, this is another good way to frame things. I mean, I like to often make the point, you've got three possibilities: one creator, many creators, and no creator. Only in the single creator model would you expect a high degree of similarity in the genetic material. If it's many creators, they're going to use a whole bunch of different templates. And if there's no creator at all, we would expect a lot of randomness generated in the templates. The fact that we don't see that, I would argue, is strong evidence that we're looking at a single creator. Anyway, back to the point. You like that good sound, buddy? All right. We were descended from yeast just a few thousands of years ago. Tilt, right. Okay. Now back to the orangutans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. And we reprinted this in Facts and Faith. What they found, the researchers, is that there is very little differentiation of Y chromosomes. If all you looked at was orangutans, or if all you looked at was chimpanzees, or if all you looked at was gorillas. And what's interesting is they looked at two strains of gorillas, the mountain gorillas and the valley gorillas. And they also discovered that there was very little differentiation in these two strains. However, when they compared valley gorillas to mountain gorillas, they found a huge difference. And when they compared orangutans to chimpanzees, they found a huge difference. Now, the Darwinian model is right. You would expect one of two things. One, that the differentiation within a species would be large. Or that you would expect that the differentiation from species to species would be small. Instead, they found the opposite. very little differentiation inside each species, but huge differentiation when you compare species to species. So that's why the researchers concluded these three cannot be descended from a common ancestor, because they're descended from a common ancestor. We expect that Y chromosome differentiation over time through natural mutations would have produced a much larger differentiation inside each species and lesser differentiation species to species. Now, we only have five species measured. The time will come we got hundreds. And so we can predict what those hundreds should produce. Okay.
Are we running the same risk using just five species and then, like, looking at in a micro way and expanding that to the macro, just like Darwin did when he looked at microevolution and saying that this is evidence of macroevolution?
Well, we can get more detailed about what we can predict. As I outlined that creation model, I made the point that if a species has large body sizes, small populations, long generation times, and doesn't produce very many children per adult, that's a species that will go extinct rapidly. And that's a species that has a zero probability for changing through mutations and natural selection. So in that sense, these Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA tests should be revealing all kinds of evidence for special creation. But, for example, when you begin to use those tests on insects, you're going to find a lot less evidence. Given that the creation model is correct, God would create a pair of cockroaches, and he really doesn't have to make new cockroach species for quite a while, because that's a species that's capable of surviving a long period of time on the Earth, even with a lot of disasters going on. It's also a species that's capable of a fair amount of change through natural selection mutations. And so we wouldn't expect as many miraculous interventions by special creation for those species as we would for birds and mammals. And the bigger the birds and mammals, the more we would expect. So, we do. No, I totally agree. We do. Right. Yeah. Yeah, when you only got three individuals, you're sticking your neck out pretty far. Well, to give you an example, I made the comment that we do see an earlier date for the first woman and the first man, and if that pans out, wouldn't that be a wonderful demonstration of the accuracy of Genesis 6, 7, and 8, where it would be, states flat out, we're all descended on the male end from Noah, not Adam, but Noah. But on the female end, there are no blood relations between the four ladies on board the ark, and so we would expect an earlier date. Now, the data already suggests that, but it only suggests it. It doesn't prove it. Because we're only looking at a few dozen individuals, and because we're only looking at a few hundred nucleotide pairs, all we can say is that there's a hint in the data that we got the first woman living a few thousand years before the first genetic man. But that's something that the book of Genesis would predict. It predicts that we should get an earlier date for the mitochondrial DNA Eve than we would the Y chromosome Adam. And we shouldn't be calling him Adam. We should be calling him Noah. We've got our neck out saying future research should bear that out. But it doesn't bear it out now. It simply suggests it. It doesn't prove it. It's not good enough to prove it. Yes. The funding and the lack of volunteers. I mean, you're typically looking at a biopsy. So now you need to line up millions of people who will volunteer to have a biopsy done on them, okay? And the technology is also new. And it takes a lot of time. For example, the discovery on the Neanderthal DNA, that was a culmination of 30 years of work by a team of a dozen anthropologists and geneticists. So, you know, when you're looking at species that have been dead for a while, then you've got a lot of hard work, because what they had to do with Neanderthal is say, all right, the mitochondrial DNA has been badly decayed by cosmic rays. So what they had to do was find pieces of mitochondrial DNA throughout the fossil sample, overlap it, and basically reconstruct what the DNA really did look like. And it took 30 years to piece it all together. This is why it can't be done for the dinosaurs. You know, we're talking dinosaurs, you're now talking millions of years, and there's been so much exposure to cosmic rays, it's hopeless to try to piece together the DNA fragments that we have and build a faithful representation of the original. Now, they've only been dead for 100,000 years or less, then we've got a hope of making it happen, but it's going to be hard work. Now, if they're still alive, it's easy, okay, because their DNA will have integrity. But the longer they've been dead, and so when they dug up those dead Japanese, one, they had a problem getting an accurate date for when that guy died. And number two, they had a problem trying to patch together the DNA from the cosmic ray damage that the body was exposed to. So those are all the problems that are involved. It's expensive, takes a lot of hard work, and you have a lot of people. But it's such important work. I think it's just a matter of time before we see the effort develop to the point where we can go after thousands. And by the way, there are some foundations that are starting to put some money into this. The Jews, for example, are beginning to fund Y chromosome research. Why? Because they think this might be a tool for picking out who the priests are within their population. So, yeah, Jeanette? Okay. What the Y chromosome analysis gives you is a date back to the first common or the most recent common ancestor. So the most recent common ancestor of men is not Adam, but Eve. And so what it does is get you back to, pardon me, Noah. Sorry, I'm getting confused here. Noah. So yeah, what the data tells you, okay, number one, you look at the differentiation, and you can test, are we descended from one man or many men? The data says one man. And then you look at people who've been dead for a while, and you can figure out, well, how far back in time do we have to go before we find that single man? But that single man is going to be Noah. It's not going to be Adam. Thank you for that clarification, Kathy. Okay, Greg. Well, it might give you a date between Noah and Eve, but there's the possibility that there's a bottleneck for women that's post-Eve. I mean, it's not likely, but it's possible. So we may find a bottleneck that's 500 years after Eve. And we may see that in the data. I mean, right now it looks like there's about a 5,000-year difference, but we may discover that the difference is only 2,000 years, and a lot of atheists are going to say, see, that overthrows the Christian model. No, wait a minute, it doesn't. Within the Christian model, there lies the possibility that you could get a bottleneck on the female side after Eve. But it's not bottlenecked at Noah. It's got to be earlier than Noah. So there should be a difference in the data if you look hard enough. You're right. If you got good enough data, you should be able to use these chemical clocks to figure out what the human population was at different epochs in the past history of our human race. It's nowhere near good enough to do that now, but it could become good enough. Another way you can use this method is to work with plants and begin to trace the history of plants. And, you know, that's already been done on wheat, where they've been able to trace the domestication of wheat from, you know, northern Mesopotamia throughout all of Europe, Asia, and Africa. We could do the same thing with a lot of weeds. We could do that with certain pests that would be attacking these domesticated fields. And we could be looking at things like rice and millet and corn and other things. And that should really help us pinpoint or nail down the spread of human civilization. And we can compare that with the Bible. Yes. You could do that if you could recover some pre-flood fossils. We don't have any. No. And that's one of the evidences I give in the Genesis question, that murder must have been pretty rife in the days before the flood, because evidently the human population never got high enough to produce these fossil finds of pre-flood humans.
So even the earliest fossils,
they're post-flood peoples. On the other hand, those post-flood peoples should be effective for helping us to confirm what we see in Genesis 10 and 11 and 12. That would be real helpful. And, for example, Jews are interested in being able to use these chemical clocks to trace that they're descended from Abraham, from Jacob and Isaac and so forth. That could be done. We could figure out, for example, how many Egyptians might have mixed in with the Jews in the Exodus. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us what the proportion of Egyptians to Jews were in the Exodus. This kind of analysis might bring that out. And we might discover it wasn't just Egyptians. After all, Egypt was a world empire. There may have been a lot of other national groups that were also mixed into that Exodus. Yes. Well, when you read the book of Exodus, it talks about the children of Israel leaving Egypt under Moses, but how the Egyptians recognized that these 10 plagues that were poured down upon them were the finger of God. And they said, we know that we are cursed and the Jews are blessed. And so what they did, a lot of Egyptians gave the Israelites a lot of gold, a lot of wealth. And, you know, God told Moses, when you leave Egypt, the Egyptians will shower upon you their wealth because they know I'm with you. Not only that happened, but a lot of them decided we're going with you. Okay? So the text in at least four places speaks about the fact that the Egyptians will be so impressed with the blessing that you've poured upon them, they will become Jews. They will go with you. Okay. I saw a hand over here in the corner of my eye. Maybe not. All right. I was going to jump into the flood. All right. Okay, I got 1 minute. All right. Just to kind of, probably got enough time here. Wait a minute, this is the wrong set. Here we go. So we've been pointing out the Bible is very clear that the flood wiped out all humanity and all the birds and mammals associated with humanity. But there's a distinction between universality and globality. The Bible teaches a universal flood that doesn't necessarily translate into a global flood. Now, the Bible is filled with examples of phrases that seem to be global, like the fact that all the kings of the earth came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, even from as far away as Ethiopia. Well, that kind of tells you that the world of Solomon didn't extend past Ethiopia. Sin is limited in its extent. The principle of judgment we see is that God never pours out judgment wrath beyond the limits of the extent of sin, which means if there weren't human beings in Antarctica, no need to flood Antarctica. And a good example of that is Sodom and Gomorrah. God limited his judgment just to the cities of the plain, even though there was wickedness beyond that realm. Limited water supply. There's not enough water on planet Earth to cover the planet with water, all the surface of the planet. In fact, it falls short by 4.5 times. This is important because the Bible text tells us that the waters of the flood are still here. And so we look at the current water content and realize it's not adequate to explain a global flood. We also realize that there isn't enough tectonics and erosion to come up with the alternate scenario. Well, what God did is he lowered the mountains during the floodwaters, and he popped them back up through plate tectonics afterwards. And that degree of plate tectonic activity and that degree of erosion would have exterminated the entire human species as well as a lot of other species of life. The ark wouldn't have survived. And hey, it gets worse than that. The global flood proponents explain continental drift through the tectonics going on during that 11-month period. That's 6,000 miles of earthquake activity in just 11 months or 12 months. The Bible tells us that the human race was failing to fill the earth. God gave the command that the earth is to be filled, and it's quite clear that the human species did not do that. The rebellion we see in Genesis 11 is one of the human race remaining in one place, united in a peace. And as we were going to be pointing out, God's intent is that there not be peace and unity and one nation, but rather division, that nations are good for us, just like it's good to have many corporations producing a product for the consumer. Likewise, it's good that there be many nations competing for citizens. And that was the problem of the days before the flood. People were staying in one place in peace and unity and using their peace and unity for evil. And this explains why God spoke so strongly to Noah about not repeating the error of Adam's descendants, but that he and his descendants had to fill the earth, meaning that they had not done that. This is consistent with the fact that there are no place names beyond Greater Mesopotamia until you hit Genesis chapter 10. Yes?
Talking about the flood levels, but the ark came to rest on Ararat, the mountain of Ararat. That's a 17,000 foot.
All right. We haven't gotten this far yet, okay? Come next week. Genesis 8:4 does not require 2 weeks, does not require the ark to land on Mount Ararat. In fact, this is what's funny. You can go around to gas stations and survey people. Where did the ark come to rest? I'll bet you 98% plus will say Mount Ararat. That's it. Big difference between the mountains of Ararat and Mount Ararat. Okay. The Hebrew word for mountains as hills, mountains, or anything in between. Unlike English, it has only a couple of words to explain relief above the plain. The ark came to rest, in my opinion, on the foothills of Ararat, just north of Nineveh. The mountains of Ararat, as any Armenian will tell you, encompasses their entire nation. We're talking 150,000 square miles. That is known as the mountains of Ararat. So the ark came to rest somewhere within that 150,000-mile geography. Looking on top of Mount Ararat is ridiculous. The biblical evidence, I would argue, is more than adequate to demonstrate the floodwaters didn't come anywhere close to even the base of Mount Ararat, let alone the summit
has there
regions.
Been any credible, I don't know much about the history of the ark and supposed sightings through time. Is there anything that's been credible?
Zero. It's all bogus, and it's a huge embarrassment to Christians when this stuff gets on TV. So, we're out of time. Yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about that next time. And by the way, it goes on. So if you want the list, this is where we're heading, okay? And don't frustrate people. But you know where we are right now? Lower animals are excluded. Everybody thinks the text talks about Noah taking on board all the animals on the face of the earth, when the Hebrew words make it quite clear, it's specific to birds and mammals. So Noah didn't have to worry about collecting 1 million species of beetles. He didn't have to take any beetles at all. God only said birds and mammals for very good reasons. Only birds and mammals can be negatively impacted by human sin. The beetles are not affected by human sin. They behave the same way in front of sinners as they do non-sinners. You might have noticed that. Hey, Rudy, I mean, it doesn't matter how godly you are in terms of the behavior of beetles in your home. So, but with the birds and mammals, it is different. Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, I pray that the building of this creation model would prove to be a message of peace and helping the different warring sides to realize that there is evidence and that we can test. This is not something that is never going to get resolved. There is the potential for resolution. And we pray, Father, that that would engender hope for believers and for non-believers, that together we may come to a recognition of the truth that you're trying to have us see and accept. I pray too, Lord, that you would bless us with hearts of humility to accept what you're revealing to us, to open our eyes and see. Lord, I'd ask that in this radio dialogue tomorrow that you would grant all of us that are participating with that humility and grace. And Lord, I just want to thank you for this class, for their prayer support, and their further eagerness to dig into these Bible texts and see everything that you have there revealed for us. Lord, equip us as we go out into the work world with our neighbors. Lord, that you would give us opportunities to share the good news, that there are reasons to believe, and that we can share this with a gentleness, respect, and clear conscience that you exhorted us to do in 1 Peter. In Jesus' name, amen.